Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2004, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a musician. His great talent is to understand and direct the human voice. He was brought up in London, the son of Italian immigrants. His father taught singing while his mother slaved as a cleaner and housekeeper. A prodigy at the piano with a following for knocking out rock music at his school in Pimlico, he became accompanist at his father's lessons. The family moved to America, where he earned pocket money playing in cocktail bars. He went on to become an accompanist for singers in rehearsal at many leading opera houses on both sides of the Atlantic, ending up as Barenboim's assistant at Bayreuth. A decade as music director at the Opera House in Brussels led to a return to the city of his upbringing. Today, the promising pupil from Pimlico is music director of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. He is Antonio Pappano. It's a romantic story, yours, Tony. Obviously, musical talent is in the blood, but your tastes are broad, aren't they? It's not only opera that you love.
I think, most influenced by my mom and dad having been such hard workers, that kind of Italian, typical Italian, working class type of person who at the drop of a hat would burst into song or something, you know, a Neapolitan song would come.
And, so if it's O Sole Mio or Santa Lucia, you can do that too?
Yeah, well,
love
yes,
too.
I can actually. I don't think anybody wants to hear me sing it, but I can do that. And it's funny, that type of spontaneity with regards to music is something that I think is very important to me. And I think this kind of blitz-like surprise that music can conjure in one leads me to be kind of very eclectic in my tastes.
I gather you also like vegging out in front of MTV, is this true?
Not so much anymore, but I watched a lot of MTV in the past, you know, when you're in hotel rooms and stuff. And that connection to when you were young and teenager and I spent a lot of my teenage working playing for my father's students. And I don't remember much about my childhood. So it's funny, through the music, through that pop music somehow, I feel, you know, something 13, 14 again, you know.
So what, you would get the Rolling Stones on one hand and Monteverdi on the other, would you? Is that the sort of
that has happened on many an occasion, actually.
Mm. There are two constants in the story, though, aren't there? One is the piano, which you were playing all that time when you worked with your father in the singing lessons, and the other is the voice. They were always there. Taking the first one, the piano, I mean, did you ever consider being a concert pianist?
I did for about 5 minutes, but I don't have the patience. I don't think, which is a terrible thing.
But you have patience with singers, and that's the other thing, the voice. And what you love, it seems to me, is that immediacy of expression of the voice. That's what touches you, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I can help or hinder. Conductors do have that power, you know, and I do my very, very best to get to really support people and to get the best out of them.
I want to hear more, but let's have your first record. What is it?
Okay. Tony Bennett with Bill Evans at the piano. This is a magical combination. They only made two records together, but this record is probably my favorite record of all recordings that exist on the planet. It's often puts me in a very melancholy mood, and therefore it can be a little bit destructive, you know, if I listen to it too often. So I hide it away. But every now and again I drag it out, and Young and Foolish.
Smiling in the sunlight, laughing in the rain, I wish that we were young and foolish again.
Great stuff. Tony Bennett singing Young and Foolish with Bill Evans on the piano. It slays you, you say, Tony.
Yeah.
Do you sing yourself?
I do, in secret. I kind of have a voice, and I love to secretly alone. They're very much alone, like to sing these songs.
Now, it's your father, of course, who had the voice. He was the son of peasant farmers east of Naples, deep, deep down in Italy. Did he suddenly wake up and with this voice? Was there a history of it in the family?
I don't think so. I mean, everybody sings in Italy in some shape, manner or form. But I think he, yeah, woke up with a voice. And he, when he was very young, sang in church. But then he left to go study in Mantova, in the north of Italy, with Professore Ettore Campogalliani, who was the most important teacher of the day.
Must have been quite an achievement for such a boy.
Well, you know, it's amazing, these people who have the courage just to pick up and go and seek out your fortune or, you know, get an education far away from where you live.
And is that why he came here? Because he came here with your mother in the 50s, I think.
Yeah, there was a... You needed to get out of Italy. There was nothing there. And there were so many people emigrating at the time. They came here partly because so many people from that village were already here, came. And so it was a kind of an enclave of people from Castelfranco.
And they came with very little.
Very little. I think a suitcase and 10 quid, you know, and I could never do that. But they came and they did anything. They worked and started to create something.
And you were born here in 1959 in Epping.
Yeah.
Did you ever see your father perform on stage?
I did, actually. I saw it was a kind of a small production of Pagliacci. And I remember, I have pictures of it. He was dressed in that clown costume. But what was so vivid was that when he murdered Nedda, it was funny because the two of us went out to buy the knife that he would have to kill her with. It was obviously in a toy shop, and it was a sort of a plastic, a retractable affair, I think. But I remember seeing this knife after the performance, and it was completely destroyed. The tension and the temperament that my father had completely smashed this knife to pieces. And I must say that scared the life out of me, and yet I was fascinated at the same time. And it's important. It's a defining moment, I think, you know, because you think that, my God, I went on to be around this kind of theater, this kind of tension, this kind of blood-curdling involvement somehow as a way of life, I do it for a living, you know.
Record number two.
There are certain singers that just take your breath away, and Franco Corelli's voice, I mean, you don't hear that kind of voice today. It just doesn't exist. This moment is opera in Italy. It's a live performance from Parma, the Teatro Regio, which are notoriously difficult public. And, of course, when you go to sing there, you're on a tightrope. And, my God, does he deliver here. And if you come to my house for dinner, you always have to listen to this because it's... and that's what I was thinking, on being on a desert island. If somebody else landed on this island, I'd entertain them with this. They said, you got to listen to this, you got to listen to this.
Cavaradossi's Vittoria, Vittoria from Act Two of Puccini's Tosca, sung by Franco Corelli with the Teatro Regio di Parma Orchestra, conducted by Giuseppe Morelli. He really hangs on that note, doesn't he? I suppose Puccini's music and the melodrama of Tosca lends itself to that kind of wallowing, but people can be quite sniffy about it, can't they?
Yes, I mean, I must say I'm very torn about things like that because obviously there's an element of vulgarity to that. Of course, I think I have good taste, but on the other hand, I think there's a part of me that has bad taste, and I'm proud of it.
But when you stand in the pit, then do you have to have a kind of vulgarometer, as it were, so that you know when the magical moves over into the vulgar and you sort of cut it?
Yes, I think every good musician has that kind of stopwatch. But often singers will have a different way of measuring these things.
Hmm. But it's in your control, is it, as conductor?
Not always.
Because they needn't look at you, of course. They can just be off and away.
But you know, it's funny, but when you're on a high note, if there's a sense like it's going to end, it's thrilling. If there's a sense you're just hanging around or you're waiting for it to get good, I think it's the most boring thing in the world.
Mm. But it's self-indulgent, isn't it?
Yes, but if it has life and it can really get you, you know.
Mm. Now, this all began, of course, as we've said, when you were accompanist at your father's lessons. Just tell me about that. How did that work? How little were you when you started doing that?
I think I started playing for my father's students when I was about 10.
Oh, you were that good that early?
Well, simple songs, little Italian arias. I was okay. I could play that stuff. Later on, when we moved to America, actually, we built two studios so that my father would work a half an hour of technical work of scales and arpeggios and breathing stuff. And then the students would come to me to work on repertoire, little songs, some pop songs, opera.
And you were in your teens.
And I was by then I was about 13, 14, and I was coaching, basically, and while he was starting the next student. So we kind of had a kind of business going, a racket.
A little family business. So you learned very early on, therefore, how to deal with the fragility of the ego on stage. And, I mean, mentioning no names, apparently that's what you're rather good at these days, is telling these big stars, the sort of difficult divas, how to behave.
Well, I don't tell them how to behave. What I do is I understand how difficult it is to stand on the stage in a heavy costume with lights coming at you, with somebody telling you to sing in tune, in time, with taste, with remember the words and everything. So I have a basic admiration for singers. Then I push for that they have to achieve not only what they know they're good at, but what they don't know they're good at, where they can go extra. And I think that's important.
Record number three.
Recording has been a big part of my life in the last 8 years or so, and I love the process so much, completely different from being in the theatre. To create a performance in a recording studio is something completely different. And the reason I chose this next record is because it contains a moment of which I'm very, very proud. It's one of my own recordings, and I thought long and hard about whether I should do this or not, but I'm very proud of having persisted to achieve something special with a singer, something so personal and so intimate.
Between Michaela and Giorgetta from Puccini's one actor Il Tabarro, The Cloak, sung by Carlo Guelfi and Maria Guleghina, with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by my castaway Antonio Pappano. Let's go back to you moving, the family moving to America, to Connecticut in the early 70s. You were just 13, as you said. Apparently, your younger brother became American, you've said, in a couple of hours flat, and you never did, although one can hear it a bit in your voice. Mm. Why did you stay apart from all of that?
Although I was quite sporty, if you like, here, I loved to play football. That, for a long time, preoccupied me much more than did music, I must say. In America, I had already made the switch to music as a future. Somehow I knew. I remember getting my grade 5 piano associated board result, and I passed with distinction. I think I got very high marks. And I remember it was like a the moment of truth. It was like a light bulb going off. So this is it. This is what I'm going to do.
But did you know what you were going to do with that?
Well, no, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I knew it was going to be music. So when I went to America, I spent less time with my colleagues in school. I didn't have many activities, sport-related activities.
Girlfriends?
In school. Not many of those either, you know. And I was very much into the music, and I became very, very concentrated. Mm. In fact, after a breakup with my first girlfriend, then I hid away. I was, you know, that was the big catalyst to go and really practice. I always need a reason somehow to practice.
What did your brother end up doing, by the way?
My brother is the manager of an auto parts shop. It's something, though, he's been doing for 20 years, and he's really kind of a virtuoso in his own right. He has 4 children. He's a terrific guy.
But couldn't be more different, you two.
Couldn't be more different. Terrific football player, though.
Echo number 4.
I grew up in America in the 70s, and you couldn't not be hooked in as a young person to groups like Earth, Wind & Fire if you were susceptible to pop music. And I was very drawn to it. I find it's somehow much sexier than classical music often. I want to be free and I want to dance, you know. I don't dance that much and I'm not very good, but I love to dance to pop music.
September from Earth, Wind and Fire. So, Antonio Pappano, apparently at some point in Connecticut, you decided, I've got to get out of here. Why did you feel that so strongly?
I realized being involved with opera had a lot to do with languages and really getting inside the languages. I needed some other experience. And the main catalyst was that I didn't speak German. I'd studied in England already French, and I felt confident. But I didn't speak German. And this was a kind of a thing that started to bother me. And I started to feel very insecure about it. So if somebody would bring something in German, I wouldn't know what it was, you know, in terms of the language. And so the first step was I got an audition with the New York City Opera as a pianist. Somebody recommended me, and I got a job. Overnight, all of a sudden, 6 days a week, I wasn't teaching with my father. It was a huge step.
Mm. He must have missed you.
Well, yeah, it was a big step. But I had my mother was behind me. You've got to do it. Come on, you've got to go. And she, you know, but I always felt very strange about how it then changed my father's life. But I did it. And through that, I was playing these big scores that I'd never played before.
But this was always as a repetiteur.
I had no visions, no aspirations to conduct.
Really?
At all.
When did that happen, then?
Well, while I was at New York City Opera, I met two people, Inga Nielsen and Robert Hale, both singers. They're married. And I coached the two of them. They saw in me something else. And Inga is Danish, and she said, you've got to come and conduct. You play the piano like an orchestra. You've got to come. And I'm doing these concerts in Denmark, and you're going to conduct. I said, but I've never conducted, really. Yeah, you can do it. And all of a sudden, I was conducting the South Jutland Symphony Orchestra, doing these arias and overtures, and I was in front of this orchestra. I couldn't conduct my way out of a paper bag, really, but I did the Fledermaus Overture, the opening. I mean, it sounded like World War III. It was so all over the place. I'll never forget it.
And did you then, what would you have been? You'd have been in your mid-20s that you suddenly thought, as you stood on that podium in South Jutland, this is what I want to do, I'm a conductor.
I still didn't. I still mixed it up until about 1987, after New York City Opera. I went to Barcelona, I went to Frankfurt. I was a pianist in Chicago at the Lyric Opera. I met Daniel Barenboim, and that was another decisive moment because he brought me to Bayreuth, to the Wagner Festival in Germany. And there I was his assistant for 6 summers.
You'd have been 27. This was
something
1986
like that.
In Bayreuth.
Yeah.
So is this the moment? I'm trying to get to this moment when you say, I am a conductor.
In 1987, I went to Oslo and I conducted La Bohème. And all of a sudden, I saw myself just take over. I said, no, you've got to do this. No, you've got to move over there. Move with this music here. When you sing that note, you've got to have a look of like this on your face, of the Musetta's aria. You've got to have a lure, and you've got to get the audience, and you've got to get the chorus with you. And all of a sudden, I was stage directing. It was the moment that I knew, this is it. This is what I am. This is what I do. And because as an opera conductor, it's not just about the music. It's fusing the music to the visual.
It's the total.
It's the total thing. Production. But then I knew that that's where I belonged.
Echo number five.
This next record, the Crommelink Duo, a wonderful pianist. And it reminds me of the time my wife, Pam, and I first got together. And at breakfast time, we would listen to this music.
One of Dvorak's Slavonic Dances, Opus 72, number 2 in E minor, played by the Crommelink Piano Duo. Antonio Papano, you spent 10 years in Brussels at La Monnaie, as you say. During that time, you were offered other jobs, I know, but you had a feeling, you said, in your bones that you were destined to come to the Opera House Covent Garden. Why?
Well, I think it was when I was reading Sir George Scholte's autobiography. There was a chapter on London. And I was reading this chapter along, and I just got this weird premonition.
Because he held the job you now hold, disappointed.
Yes, exactly.
At the opera house,
yeah. And I...
What sort of premonition? Did you read it and thought, I'd like to do that, or something?
Maybe I shouldn't have had that premonition, because I conducted once before, disastrously, in 1990 at Covent Garden. I was just too inexperienced to handle it.
But in spite of that...
So there was part of that, and part of, you know, I've got to set this thing straight, you know, because it was so not good when I was first here. So it was a little bit of both, you know.
You parted company recently with the architect Daniel Libeskind, didn't you, who had been commissioned to design the sets for the new Ring cycle, mm-hmm. which begins next year. You know, how difficult... Well, what was wrong with that? What was wrong with his sets? And how difficult was it to reject them?
First of all, Daniel Libeskind is a wonderful man, a fantastic artist and craftsman and a great genius. But architects tend to think of stationary structures, of course. And something like Das Rheingold has four definite scenes, and there has to be movement between these scenes. And I think just the fact that something has to move and has to be flexible was, I think, alien to Daniel's world.
And then, of course, there was recently the story of the soprano Deborah Voigt, from whom, again, the Opera House parted company. She'd been booked to play Ariadne auf Naxos, which is a kind of signature role of hers, but she's a woman of ample proportions, and I think it was felt she wouldn't look right in the part. Again, that's a change of approach, isn't it? Because, you know, for years, for decades, Pavarotti, a man of extremely ample proportions, has played romantic leads. Does it come down to this wanting the total theatrical presentation? People have got to look right as well now.
I think that's part of the story. I think, like Pavarotti, I think you don't expect to see Pavarotti move very much on stage. And I think in this production of Ariadne auf Naxos, it's actually the quality of movement that was very important. It's not about the slinky dress. It has nothing to do with it. The whole picture of the production and the movement, I just don't think would have suited her. I mean, this was a decision made among the whole artistic team. It's unfortunate that a private matter between the Covent Garden Opera House and Deborah Voigt became such a sort of feeding frenzy for the press. Artistic matters are artistic matters.
Record number six.
Well, I think if you're on a desert island, you can fall into a stupor if you're not careful. And I think that you need to be reminded of life's energy and life's force. And Beethoven is so somehow so basic and so natural that you need to be reminded of what's somehow what's possible.
Opening of Beethoven's Fifth, played by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Carlos Kleiber. I see that you've cast away the baton, Tony, these days. You conduct with your hands. Is there a reason for that?
Last season, at the end of the season, I had tremendous problems with tennis elbow. And I'll never forget, it was in a performance of I Pagliacci, and the baton just came flying out of my hand at one moment, you know, as it sometimes happens, goes. I think it went into the audience. And I have a spare one there on my music stand, and I decided I'm not going to pick it up. And I just said, let me give this a try. Let me see what happens. And two things happened. All of a sudden, the pain in my elbow just disappeared. And all of a sudden, this feeling of embracing the orchestra and making more flowing movements, more expressive movements with my hands happened. I think I've become, warmer and more expressive without using the baton. At least that's what people tell me.
You're liberated.
I'm liberated.
Feeling of liberation. Your nickname at the Opera House is Mr. Motivator, you know, after all the problems that accompanied the restoration and so on. You breathed new spirit, new life into the place, they say. I mean, there have been some blips, and I don't mention them, it would be churlish to do so, but I just wonder if you're learning anything about what the audience wants, what the British audience wants, as opposed to your experiences in Europe.
I think this is one of the biggest challenges of being an artistic director of an institution like Covent Garden. It's an international institution. We have international singers here. We have the quality of the orchestra is international, chorus. But, of course, I am somebody who is interested in the total picture in theatre and psychological working through of the characters, not just the singers we know and love and listen to them singing, just, you know, all dressed up in a costume standing in the front of the stage. I'm not saying that that doesn't belong at Covent Garden, because I think we have beautiful old productions that absolutely belong at Covent Garden. And what I love is actually to have a library of productions that mixes the old with the new. And I think that one of the challenges for me is to come to terms with the fact that certain things work in certain countries. Certain
things don't work. What doesn't work here?
Well, I think an overly conceptual approach to opera production, you know, I challenge myself to get it right. And why did this work? And why didn't this work? I ask myself the questions. But, you know, I think it's an exchange. Theater is an exchange of ideas, of emotions. And I think this is very important, that it's not just the fun night out, the opera. It can be, and It should be on...
They're paying big money for it. You know, it's got to be fun. It's got to be entertaining.
Yes, it can be, but it depends on the piece. If you come to Simon Boccanegra, it's not a fun night out. It's a deep experience, and opera can be many, many things. And that's what, I don't think opera is one thing. I think it's many things. And the fact that we have a Bob Wilson production next to Schlesinger production of Rosenkavalier and Moschinsky production of Simon Boccanegra next to a Tom Cairns production of The Tempest, this is what I want this opera house to be. I want it to be many things.
Record number 7.
You know, if you're on a desert island, I think you need to be made to smile and to laugh. And Louis Prima makes me smile.
In the modern San Yadina, we'll go walking where the mountains of the sun come into sight. And by the little jewelry shop, we'll stop and linger while I buy a wedding ring. And in the meantime, let me tell you that I love you. Hey, buonasera, signorina, kiss me good.
Louis Prima and Buonasera. Good fun, actually. You'll be jogging up and down to that one on your desert island. Your parents are still around. They're still in America. What do they think of this son of theirs, this sort of pianistic prodigy who's now risen to the top of his profession?
Well, they're extremely proud. I call them every day. Actually, I speak to them every day and I tell them about, you know, this performance or this recording session or this. But I'm not allowed to say, oh, that didn't go so well or that didn't. My mother will scream, what's the matter with you? You're the best. Why you always put yourself down? My father says, you know, and so they don't let me wallow in self-pity at all, which is followed me through my career, actually. It's been a wonderful antidote, you know. If they think I'm the best, then that's cool with me.
Wonderful. How are you going to cope on this desert island we're sending you to? Are you any good? Are you practical in any way?
I'm totally impractical. That's why I, in a way, maybe brought this book, you know, Mark Twain, with me, because I'm very... I was very affected by Huckleberry Finn and The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And I figure there's a chance that maybe I will learn how to make a raft somewhere in this book, must be, to get off.
But, I mean, if you're completely impractical, you can at least stand there and conduct all these pieces of music, can't you? And this, it's a wonderful, eclectic list. What's the last one on it?
It's a slow movement from the great B-flat sonata of Schubert. I chose this record as much for the pianist, Richter, Sviatoslav Richter, as for Schubert. You know, everybody has their own touch on the piano, and Richter's is very, very special. He always inspires me to try and achieve something as special to myself at the piano.
Part of the slow movement from Schubert's piano sonata in B-flat major, D960, played by Sviatoslav Richter. Now, if you could only take one of those 8 records with you, Tony, which one would you take?
Tony Bennett, Bill Evans.
Would you?
Definitely.
You've told us your book is Huckleberry Finn. What about your luxury? One luxury. No practical value.
I've always been looking for, you know, I'm always trying to squeeze a minute here, 2 minutes there, trying to practice the piano, and I would want to take a piano with me. I just feel what an opportunity to finally just get it together, you know.
Antonio Papano, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.